Some podcasts are great. Some podcasts achieve greatness. And some podcasts have greatness thrust upon them. And then there's Swerpcast. Now I've yet to find an excuse for that. So, it is with great thanks that we welcome you to our third anniversary episode, Twerpcast number 39, CameronCast, wherein we will discuss all things James Cameron. Now, I would like to introduce you to a man even Hamlet would pity, executive producer and Prince of Denmark, James Caswell.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerps, and one of the many men who was able to identify with Sully when Dr. Augustine told him, "Don't play with that! You'll go blind!"
Well, despite the fact that we've been gone for 2 months, we have not been canceled. We'd like to thank you for your patience and let you know we'll be back.
Each year, we've made it a bit of a tradition to focus in for our anniversary issues on a particular creator, artist, master of the arts, someone who is tri-talented.
Yes, that's somebody who'll try anything.
And this year, we actually had several to choose from, but we finally decided that today's feature was our best choice because it was the most current, and honestly, he's the most prosperous science fiction creator in history.
He's the king of the world!
How many times are we going to use that during this episode? Of course, we are talking about producer, writer, director extraordinaire, James Francis Cameron.
James Cameron was born in Ontario, Canada, August 16, 1954. He attended Stamford College in Niagara Falls. He moved to Brea, California in 1971, studying physics and English at Fullerton College and California State University. Finally, he chose a philosophy major at Fullerton College in 1973. And he used the USC library to learn about special effects. Eventually, he dropped out and became a truck driver. Cameron was inspired by Star Wars and Sid Field's book to enter the film industry. Jim, why don't you tell us about some of his early projects?
I'd be happy to, Doug. His first entry into filmmaking was a 10-minute short that he both wrote and filmed called Xenogenesis. This little-known, little-seen project really was his first attempt at not only learning about filmmaking in general, but also the technology of filmmaking. There's a story that floats around out there about how he spent his first day of production working on putting the camera that he had rented back together again because he had taken it apart just to find out how it worked. After making this short film, he went to work for Roger Corman Studios as a miniature model maker. From there, he worked his way up to secondary director positions on Battle Beyond the Stars in 1980, Escape from New York in 1981, and Galaxy of Terror in 1981.
Galaxy of Terror is the only one I don't own.
You've actually seen Battle Beyond the Stars?
I own Battle Beyond the Stars, and many Roger Corman films.
He was hired on as the art director for Piranha 2, The Spawning, in 1981. But when the original director quit, Cameron was promoted to being head director, and this proved to be his directorial debut, much to his own chagrin. This probably also helps explain why he proceeded to write and produce the rest of his movies himself. Supposedly, it was during this time that he was working on this movie that he was having so many problems, both with production and dealing with the studio, that he had reoccurring dreams about a robot hitman from the future coming back in time to kill him. Sounds like a movie.
Yeah, it was actually this movie concept that got him his whopping $8 million to do a little robot flick called The Terminator.
The Terminator was produced in 1984, and it not only kicked off the directorial career of James Cameron, but also put a couple of no-name actors into a role where they might develop a acting career. You know, this guy from Austria and an actress named Linda something or another. All joking aside, this really was one of those little movies that could. It was considered very low budget for a science fiction film of its day, and in spite of the fact that Star Wars had pretty much established the blockbuster summer ideal, science fiction still wasn't getting a whole lot of credit in Hollywood. So the fact that Terminator was able to come out and hit a very wide fan base, and it essentially became a cult hit, really said a lot for the film.
I don't think in the late 70s and early 80s
people in general were prepared to realize that 9 of the top 10 highest grossing movies ever would be science fiction. Science fiction movies were really looked down upon by the studios, by the critics, and by the audiences. But it's this period of time that brings us Star Wars, Indiana Jones, E.T., The Terminator. We're talking all these movies that made hundreds of millions of dollars.
And, with the exception of E.T., spawned huge franchises.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think now people are willing to say, oh, you're James Cameron? You can have as much money as you want to make a movie because we're going to make it back. But when Terminator was made, they were like, you get $8 million and we're going to put you on a really, really short leash.
You better hope and pray that you make that $8 million back. Otherwise, you're never going to work in this town again.
Not to get really off topic, but for George Lucas, the studio had such little confidence in this movie that they let George Lucas retain all the rights to merchandising and the toys and everything like that. And the merchandising alone has made George Lucas a multi-hundred millionaire.
At the same time that Cameron was writing Terminator, he was also writing a couple of other scripts for sequels, kind of on spec. He not only wrote The Terminator, but at the same time he was writing Rambo First Blood Part 2. And he wrote Aliens, all at the same time. His part in Rambo, he was given credit for writing the original screenplay, but that's about the extent of what he did. He turned what he had over to Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone made tweaks to it and ran with it.
And yet it was still his highest grossing movie ever. Sylvester Stallone, that is, not James Cameron.
But, as I said, he also took on a second franchise to create what was probably the most popular movie in the Alien series, Aliens, in 1986. This one he came on as the director as well, and took what was, like The Terminator, a fairly low-budget science fiction film, and turned it into a blockbuster.
Realistically, both Terminator and the original Alien were really intended for the horror movie genre. They do fit into the horror/sci-fi end of the spectrum, but they were looking for the quick, dirty, and cheap, we're going to get all our money back in the first weekend.
Quick, make our money before people learn how bad this really is.
It just turned out that these were spectacular movies.
Whoops!
Like The Terminator, Aliens launched the career of a lot of people. Okay, Sigourney Weaver had been around, but again, this really put her name on the page. Paul Reiser was in this. Something that James Cameron really likes to do is take his actors that he likes working with and thinks are talented and bring them back. Bill Paxton had a very small role in The Terminator, but then he had more of a leading role in Aliens. One of the main characters from Terminator was played by Michael Biehn. Biehn was brought back to play Corporal Hicks in Aliens, and then he played Lieutenant Coffey in the following movie, The Abyss. So when James Cameron finds somebody that he likes and that is talented, he will use the hell out of them.
Aliens also holds the distinction of showing Cameron wasn't going to be a one-trick pony. He was able to take two movies back-to-back, make a nice profit margin, which allowed them to give him a little bit more freedom and go, you want to make a movie about aliens underwater? Okay, we'll trust you on this. Go on ahead, go for it. Which allowed him to make The Abyss in 1989.
I guess I would liken Abyss to a proto-Avatar. Here was an area where James Cameron knew he wanted to do something that had never been done before, so he had to invent all of the technology himself. He had the studio buy an unused nuclear reactor so he could fill it up with water. The wetsuits he designed from scratch so that you could see the actors' faces.
He was also one of the first to use the technology that allowed for liquid CGI movement, so that when the creatures came up out of the water and made this cylinder of water, you could see reflections in it, and you could see it shape and mold and turn and essentially create special effects that would later go on to be used for the T-1000 in Terminator 2.
It was The Abyss that really jump-started the whole use of CGI as a major character player in movies.
One of the many things that James Cameron is known for is, as opposed to George Lucas, who will make a movie and then go out and go, oh, well, the technology is better now, I'm going to re-edit the movie with newer technology, James Cameron will actually wait for the technology to catch up with his ideas, and then make the movie that he wanted to make in the first place. He will wait for the technology, or he will go on out there and have people create the technology, especially for that project. And he's been a groundbreaker.
Absolutely. James Cameron knows what he wants, and he knows how to get it. I would argue that is with special effects, that's with actors, that's probably with writers, producers, studio executives.
Yeah, today, studios love for James Cameron to walk into their office and go, "Hi, give me $200 million to make a movie." And they go, "Are you sure that's all you want?"
It's funny to say that today, because when they were producing Titanic, and it kept going over budget, and going over budget, and going over budget, I remember the news articles during the production. There was a huge uproar about how it went over $100 million and no movie had ever gone over $100 million. And then it went over budget again until the news articles were like, they won't tell us how much money it cost, but we know for a fact it's over $200 million. This could be the biggest flop ever in history. That was the way it was portrayed before it hit the theaters. Sorry for jumping ahead a couple of movies.
Let's jump back to our timeline. Cameron followed The Abyss with the sequel to Terminator, Terminator 2 Judgment Day, in 1991. He took the technology that he had established in The Abyss, worked with it, shaped it some more, created an interactive CGI character that was interchangeable with an actor to create the T-1000.
And again, James Cameron has been this technological innovator, really heavily using the CGI process, creating the underwater scenes for The Abyss. In Terminator 2, he was one of the real heavy innovators of the motion capture system, a precursor to the performance capture system he used in Avatar. After Terminator 2, he did the one movie of everything that I would not give four pens in the pocket protector, True Lies, which is just so different from everything else he's done. I'd still give it three pens in the pocket protector because Arnold and Tom Arnold worked really well together.
Honestly, I would give that movie 3.5 pens in the pocket protector because outside of the James Bond films, I have to say that True Lies is probably my favorite spy film. Not only do you have Arnold Schwarzenegger and Tom Arnold working extremely well together in the buddy cop movie mold, but you have Jamie Lee Curtis just doing a wonderful job, both as the innocent wife who is kind of being duped by her husband, but also as the movie progresses as an action leading lady herself. You've also got excellent special effects in play, big scale adventure, including having Schwarzenegger flying a Harrier next to a skyscraper, firing into the building to kill the terrorists. This was just wonderful. And you get the introduction to an actress by the name of Eliza Dushku.
Well, you have to have a little faith in her career.
It had a really strong cast to it. Tia Carrera as the femme fatale was just wonderful.
And Bill Paxton, again, and probably one of the funniest roles I've ever seen him in. He plays the fake secret agent that's trying to seduce Arnold's wife.
He is hilarious in that role.
Incontinent. The joke that always goes well.
If you're a James Cameron fan and you've never seen True Lies because it's not science fiction, you still got to go see it. It is hilarious. It's fun. It does have hints of science fiction. I mean, anybody who can fly a Harrier up right next to a building and fire into the building and not lose his job for it, that's science fiction.
But True Lies is not the only non-science fiction movie that James Cameron has produced, written, and directed. There's that little one.
The one about the boat. To say that this was the movie about the boat really is stretching it, because the actual history of the Titanic doesn't play so much a part in this as much as it being a romantic drama.
This movie is a romantic drama. The setting is on the boat.
Of course, we are talking about 1997's Titanic, the highest grossing movie ever until Avatar. It won the Best Director Oscar, it won the Best Movie Oscar. Basically, if Titanic was up for an award that year, it won. It sent teeny bopper girls back to the theaters over and over and over and over again.
No, Jim, let's just face it. If you had a vagina, it was in the seat in the movie theater.
Over and over and over again. And honestly, that's how it made its money. women just loved Leonardo DiCaprio, loved the romantic story, loved everything about it, and just continually went back over and over again that year. Of course, Avatar had the advantage of charging twice and three times the amount for your average ticket because of 3D and IMAX, but we're not going to go into that.
So all of these ticket sales actually leads to Titanic being the highest grossing movie of the 20th century.
Yeah, that 9 out of 10 being science fiction, this is at number 10.
I know there's a lot of talk, well, why don't you adjust this for ticket sales? Because then a movie like E.T. actually jumps much higher on the list because it's still in the top 10, and they were selling tickets for like $3 a piece for this movie.
Honestly, when you adjust for inflation, Gone with the Wind is actually the highest grossing film of all time. But when you're talking bare bones, dollars to donuts, Titanic was the number one grosser.
Donuts.
As Doug said earlier, Titanic cost a whole lot of money to make. Part of that was because Cameron created his own ocean on a back lot to film on. A lot of special effects, a lot of CGI work that was very, very subtle. It didn't take you out of the moment, but yet allowed him to recreate the sinking of this huge luxury liner. I can honestly say, as a guy, I didn't get as much out of it as 99% of the female population of the United States at that time. I thought it was an okay movie. Not fantastic, not great, it was entertainment. It was a good way to spend 3 hours, once.
Oh, with that second part of the equation, I agree completely. Really, I thought this was one of the most fantastically produced movies I've ever seen. I truly would give it 4 pens in the pocket protector. That being said, it is a chick flick. It's not science fiction, not really the genre that motivates me to see a movie a second time. I will recommend it to anyone who's never seen it. I think it's an excellent way to spend 3 hours one time.
But when you see the ending of it, and you know that the boat sinks, and that people die, you pretty much know the end of the story.
Gave away the surprise ending, Jim! How dare you!
Whoops, I didn't realize that people didn't know that the Titanic sank, and that people died that day. So, how do you follow up the highest grossing movie in history? Most people would look at it and go, Titanic 2, The Revenge!
I think that would almost be as good as Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season.
Yeah, can't you picture it? The Titanic gets possessed by the ghosts of all the people who died, and the ghosts bring it back to the surface to go on a killing spree. Yeah, that sounds like a blockbuster film.
About as good as Hamlet Part 2.
And as much as we joke about it, you know that somewhere in Hollywood in 1998... there was an executive for a studio that was just dying because James Cameron refused to do a sequel to the Titanic.
But in answer to your question, how do you follow up the Titanic? From the TV studio point of view, this is a bit of brilliance. Let's take somebody who made the highest grossing movie of all time and have him do a television show, because that means you're going to have a built-in audience that's huge.
That's the premise that Fox came up with. Whoops, wait a second. We just found the flaw in the plan. It's being put out by Fox.
Fox doesn't get sci-fi, period.
We could list off all of the evidence of how badly Fox doesn't get science fiction.
Rather than really going into this, why don't you just listen to the Joss Whedon cast?
The Joss Whedon cast, the Termacast, our comments about Dollhouse. Yeah, there's a nice long list of Fox failures. To its credit, Dark Angel, executive produced by James Cameron, actually managed to stay on the air for 2 years before it was killed.
And I didn't much like it, which I don't think is James Cameron's fault. It was just really too damn slow for me.
It was a very slow progression story. It had a lot of positive things going for it. It introduced the world to Jessica Alba.
That's 2 reasons right there.
It was a pretty good interpretation of taking the superhero genre, mixing in a heavy portion of cyberpunk, and still making it palatable to a Fox-size audience.
Again, I think that was one of the problems with it, is it was too dumbed down for its intended audience, and it was too smart for the general audience.
Yeah, when you look at season two, I have to agree, because season two really did kind of dumb things down and almost made it less palatable. But, as I said, it also introduced the world to Jessica Alba.
James Cameron's got good taste. Linda Hamilton, Jessica Alba, Tia Carrera, Sigourney Weaver. I mean, the guy knows talented women that are attractive.
Dark Angel was on the air from 2000 to 2002, two seasons worth. They are available on DVD. I highly recommend that you at least rent them. If you have a nice long weekend, like we just celebrated Memorial Day weekend, you have a good 3 days where you have nothing better to do with your time, congratulations. But on top of that, go on out and rent the show. Sit down and watch them back to back. It'll move pretty quickly for you, relatively speaking, and you can actually enjoy a pretty decent story.
I won't begrudge you that. It was not my favorite television show of all time, but I would certainly not tell somebody to avoid it at the same time. It's worth sitting down and seeing once. I mean, I won't praise it, but I'm not going to put it down either.
Yeah, it's definitely a rental. We can't necessarily recommend you buy it, but it's definitely a rental. That kept him busy from 2000 to 2002. At that point, things went slightly askew for him. He decided to start getting into producing some documentaries, which, when you look at his career of science fiction production, switching over to documentaries seems like a little bit of a leap. But when you look at what he was doing at the same time, it's not as big of one as you might think. His first work was in 2002 with a documentary called Expedition Bismarck, where they took cameras underwater and explored the wreckage of the Bismarck. He followed that by Ghosts of the Abyss, which was, again, revisiting Titanic, this time actually going into the water with 3D cameras, exploring the wreckage, and what life was like aboard the ship. Now, you'll notice I said 3D cameras. This was really one of his first forays into 3D. He also made it for the IMAX theaters. So, let's see. Really huge screen in 3D. What does that remind us of?
Oh, it was absolutely practice. There's no doubt about it that although he was not filming a science fiction film, that he was getting ready in his mind to make the film he wanted to do for most of his life.
Yeah, he even actively admits to the fact that he was working with 3D at that time to get ready for Avatar. And then in 2005, he followed it up with Tony Robinson's Titanic Adventure. Yes, that was 2005. His next work was in 2009, Avatar. He spent 4 years writing, getting the production together, filming, doing the special effects, getting everything in line to produce the highest grossing film of all time.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, he is very controlling. He knows exactly what he wants, to the point where he was working with Sony to develop the 3D cameras that he would use to shoot this film. He's essentially the lead developer on the performance capture system that they would use for the CGI on this film.
As much as people like to give George Lucas credit for CGI work and motion capture work, Cameron really was the pioneer on all of this.
I love ILM. I think that they really do create magic. I think their name is incredibly apt. And until very recently, I would say ILM can do no wrong. But I've seen Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Now I know better.
Yeah, Avatar drew you into the world of the movie using the CGI. Indiana Jones 4 knocked you out of the movie using CGI.
I hate to get off topic, but boy, it sure looked like, gee, there's Shia LaBeouf against a green screen.
Yeah, we could just spend more time dissing on Indiana Jones 4.
And refrigerators that can withstand nuclear explosions.
But instead, we're going to save ourselves some time. Go on back and listen to IndieCast. You'll hear all of our rant and raving. We don't need to repeat it here.
Aliens from another dimension.
We don't need to repeat it here.
Crystal skulls in Machu Picchu.
We don't need to cover it here. We've kind of covered ground on Avatar before. If you go back to our Oscar cast from earlier this year, we go into a great deal of detail about it. You'll learn that Doug just absolutely adored this movie. I enjoyed it. He loved it in 3D. I saw it in 2D. He still wants me to go see it in 3D so I can get the full effect of it.
If you have the chance to see this movie in 3D, and you haven't yet, see it in 3D. It changes, if not filmmaking forever, it changes 3D filmmaking forever. It is a fully immersive experience, unlike the old days where it was just the gimmick. Oh, there's a pool cue sticking out of the air. There's bubbles coming my way. Somebody hit a baseball into the audience. It's not like that. It actually feels like you're inside the spaceship. When you're in the jungle, you actually feel like you're in the jungle. It's just so incredible, and it doesn't put you off of the movie. And I think a lot of times in the olden days, the 3D actually put you out of the movie.
And from what I'm understanding, some of it in the new days too. You got to be careful what you see in 3D even today, but the technology is light years ahead of where it was.
Yeah, Ice Age 3D, not really important to see.
And in that regard, I will give him major kudos, because just like he innovated a new level of CGI, he has innovated a new form of filmmaking. Everybody and their brother wants to do 3D now because Avatar was successful in doing 3D and made a lot of money doing it. Everybody wants to make 3D now.
Now I know why Speed Racer didn't work. It should have been in 3D.
It was already psychedelic. It should have been in 3D psychedelic. Make you feel like you smoked pot, even if you didn't.
Yeah, imagine the Doors in 3D.
I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who saw the Doors in 3D.
They didn't need the glasses either. The D stands for Doobie.
The impact of the success of 3D can even be seen in television now, because there are several companies that build TVs who are now making 3D televisions in expectation of a surge in 3D use. And we're not just talking about movies, but we're talking sporting events are talking about going to 3D.
This is the only reason I don't think that 3D is going to fail. I believe when people start watching football, baseball, hockey, basketball in 3D, that you're going to see bars in 3D. You're going to see households in 3D. You're going to have mega fans everywhere watching this stuff in 3D. And that's why it's not going to fail.
The only way that I could possibly see it failing would be if you have a resurgence of what people used to do for widescreen TVs and for high-definition TVs, doing it for 3D TVs. And that was when the Super Bowl came along, they'd go on out and they'd buy a television set just for the Super Bowl, and then they'd return it Monday morning.
I think electronics sales is really onto that now, and charging that 15 or 20% restocking fee keeps a lot of people from doing that.
Or people just see it as rental fee. I really do feel that it could go either way at this point. I think that the TV technology still has a ways to go before it truly becomes popular. But the fact that they're willing to take those first steps, make those first investments, shows that they believe that there is going to be a market out there for it.
As far as the TV technology goes, I completely agree with you on that. I don't really see a big market for Survivor 3D, The Incredible Race 3D, or, God forbid, Big Brother in 3D.
The Biggest Loser in 3D.
Ew!
Even worse, MTV's Shot of Love in 3D. Ew, the crabs are crawling at me!
Christy Alley's Big Life in 3D.
I'm gonna be smushed!
Do we beat a dead horse much? I mean, okay, yes, I don't like reality shows, so I'm picking on them here. But in all seriousness, once you leave the realm of CSI and NCIS, do you really need 3D? Two and a Half Men, is 3D really going to add anything to that?
As we said before, that is one of James Cameron's reoccurring themes. He is heavily influenced by technology. In fact, he is a pioneer of movie technology.
But that's not all of his recurring themes. There are things that really do go through all of his movies. For instance, I think the easiest one to start with is, I would call James Cameron a feminist. He really does portray strong female characters in such a way that they're not bitches. I think that's incredibly important because Hollywood is a male-driven society, and so a lot of movies that have these strong female characters make them the bitch of the story.
You can have a leading lady who is compassionate yet strong, who is not alienating everyone around her. Yeah, that makes for a good villain, but it doesn't make for a good female protagonist.
So I think what he does successfully is portray women as women, and these women happen to be incredibly strong role models at the same time.
You want a few examples? Look at Sarah Connor. Look at Ellen Ripley. Look at Max from Dark Angel. All extremely strong women.
Terminator has this brilliant story arc for Sarah Connor. At the beginning of the movie, she is this waitress who doesn't think anything of herself. She doesn't have strong self-esteem. I don't want to say she sees herself as a victim, but I certainly feel that she is victimized. Here she is, thinking that she doesn't amount to anything. And we watch her become this strong, independent woman as the movie develops. And then by the end of it, she's somebody who knows how to make bombs, somebody who knows how to fire a gun, and somebody who can, on her own, kill a Terminator.
And the trend even continued into Avatar. Neytiri was an extremely strong female character. She was a leader within her tribe. Yeah, her father was the chief, but it wasn't because of her father that people looked to her. It was because of her own strength. She had the courage to accept the fact that this outsider was coming in and took him under her wing to train him how to become a Na'vi.
She had the courage of her convictions, as they say. She knew it was against their traditions, and she was willing to fight for what she believed in.
Now, this is not to say that James Cameron is completely and holistically supportive of all forms of humanity.
I think you're getting political, because I believe that James Cameron does have a love for humanity, which is why he has a political agenda.
So technically, it's not me that's getting political, but him.
I don't believe that James Cameron has ever said he didn't have a political agenda. Oliver Stone has a political agenda. Michael Moore has a political agenda. I mean, there are a lot of filmmakers, and not all of them are on the left. They're just easier for me to say because I agree with them. He's certainly shown that corporations are soulless. And in so much that a corporation is a legal entity and not a person, I agree, a corporation is soulless. He makes the representative soulless also.
In a lot of his movies, Aliens, Terminator 2, in a lot of ways, Avatar. Big business corporation equals bad.
Now, at the very moment we're recording, there's a BP oil platform in the Gulf that's leaking millions of gallons of oil into the ocean.
Yeah, we're not saying that he's necessarily wrong. In fact, it's sometimes very interesting how corporations like to prove him as being right. We're just saying that it's one of his reoccurring themes. Some could say that in Avatar, the military is bad. But in all honesty, it isn't the military that's involved on Pandora. It's essentially hired mercenaries by the corporation. So it isn't so much that the military is bad, as much as, again, pointing back to the corporations.
I don't see anywhere in any of his movies where he said being military is inherently bad. In Aliens, it was the military that was protecting Ellen Ripley. They were there to rescue the people of the colony. He really is showing the corporations being bad. And in the case of Pandora, there were mercenaries who were following orders.
Another one of his common themes is the reconciliation between humanity and technology. Even when technology is out to get humanity, it works towards finding a common balance between the two. It wasn't so much that case in the original Terminator. But as he's advanced through time, it's become a little bit more and more apparent. Ripley's use of the loader to get herself to be equal with the alien queen. It was Brigman being able to use the deep water suit that allowed him to go and meet up with the aliens. In Terminator 2, the aligning and friendship that developed between the T-800 and John Connor.
Let's go right to Avatar. Without technology, none of the characters would have been able to move from their human bodies into their Na'vi bodies. That was a technological achievement. It was only the Na'vi who were able to get them to actually physically move their soul from one body to the next.
But it was the use of technology that got them up to that stage. So while corporations may be bad, technology is good. And then the last of the reoccurring themes that we'll probably hit on is the fact that as good as humanity may be, we're really, really good at repeating our mistakes. We just don't seem to learn.
If you look at the abyss, it's what we're doing to the oceans. And we've been doing this for hundreds of years, whether it's hunting whales to extinction or dumping our trash in the ocean so that there's actually a trash island floating in the ocean right now. Again, Avatar is the most recent one, but he tells the Avatar, we didn't learn. We destroyed our world. There's nothing green on it. And not to stop my political agenda, but there is a certain amount of that actually happening. We're deforesting the rainforest. We only have like 10% of the national forest of United States left. We are degreening our own planet. Now, I think it's come to the point where we recognize that, and it doesn't matter which side of the political aisle you're on, there's some amount of we need to keep green.
His interpretation of repeating mistakes does lean quite heavily towards what happens if we use it all up? What happens if we destroy it all? What happens if we fail to acknowledge the threat of nuclear Armageddon and we blow everything to kingdom come?
My favorite little revelation on the degreening of the world is a sight gag in the movie Soylent Green. And you go to Central Park, and Central Park is a dome that covers the last tree in the world. And I just thought that was a piece of brilliance which has lasted 40 years.
And actually, that is a perfect example of it. This has been something that has been floating around in the human condition for over 40 years, and yet we still do it. We still damage the environment. We still continue to rely so heavily on oil that we're pretty much willing to let oil companies do whatever they feel like because we're so dependent upon them. I'm not one of the independent truthers, but I'm willing to acknowledge the fact that there is a finite amount of stuff out there, and if we use it all up, we're pretty much hosed.
Jim, I really don't think I have anything to add to that. I think you said it perfectly well.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
Avatar, highest grossing movie of all time. But it's not James Cameron's last movie, thank God. There's a whole laundry list of projects that he has that are still out there.
Now, keep in mind that any projects that James Cameron has had his name attached to at this point, it could be something that he could work on in the next year. It could be something that is 10 years down the line. It all depends on how he sees himself doing it. We've already said he is well known for waiting for technology to catch up with his ideas. In a lot of ways, he's like the anti-Lucas, or George's good twin, depending on your point of view. He'll wait for the technology to catch up with him, whereas George Lucas will just go back and redo it over and over and over again and make more money. I mean,
there are a lot of people out there who would disagree with you. I'm not one of them, but there are people out there who really love George Lucas, who look at the 6 Star Wars films as the pinnacle of achievement in science fiction.
I could agree with half of that.
There is a lot about Star Wars that I love. There's a lot of things that George Lucas ripped off, nevertheless did very well. There's a lot of things that George Lucas created himself and did very well. And there's a number of things that George Lucas just did incredibly poorly.
Howard the Duck.
Han Solo shot first.
A smaller Jabba the Hutt? What?
I guess my personal opinion is that George Lucas doesn't really have the creativity, doesn't have the extent of the skill that James Cameron has. They're really two different animals, in my opinion. I don't see a George Lucas Titanic. I don't see a George Lucas True Lies.
George Lucas tried to do True Lies. It was called Indiana Jones, and it was very successful. And that's not to say that everything that George Lucas is bad. Don't get me wrong, don't think that I'm saying that. I'm saying that George Lucas doesn't walk on water like a lot of people think that he does. As good as some of the stuff is that he has done in the past, what has he done for us lately? You've got James Cameron on one side who's given us Avatar, and you've got George Lucas on the other side who has given us Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and yet another version of Star Wars that he can make money off of. One side is very, very creative, like you said. The other side is kind of rehashing stuff that he did 20 years ago.
My biggest complaint with George Lucas is that he is one of the worst offenders in the double-dipping department.
I think he's managed to get it up to the quadruple dipping at this point.
Again, there's nothing wrong in a capitalist society with making money. To quote Michael Douglas, greed is good. And he's not the only one that's in on this. There's going to be 3 separate releases of Avatar. Avatar the theatrical release, Avatar the extended edition, and Avatar the 3D edition. James Cameron's double dipping also.
For Star Trek fans, Paramount. Enough said.
But to repeat myself, what Cameron really has is that incredible creativity and being always on the cutting edge. He is an innovator. He's not somebody who makes a copy movie. In fact, he doesn't even copy his own. Terminator 2 is the only sequel he's done so far.
So far.
Well, we know there's going to be more Avatars out there. You don't make the biggest money-making movie of all time and have the studio go, come on, we really want Titanic 2.
It's just in Avatar's case, he realized, hey, wait a second, this story can actually continue after the boat has sank.
Yes, it turns out the boat seeking was a dream sequence.
And yes, one of the many things that he has planned is Avatar sequels. He's said that the sequels will delve deeper into the world of Pandora.
Literally, he said that he wants to do an underwater Avatar.
Again, one of the few things that he said. The Avatar 2 won't be called Avatar, but it will be set underwater on Pandora, and he wants the third movie to be in the space surrounding the planet Pandora. So he's got an underwater adventure and a space flick in mind. He is currently working as the executive producer of a movie coming out later this year called Sanctum, which is about divers that are trapped in a cave-in. He also has on his plate a live-action adaptation of the first three volumes of a manga series called Battle Angel. But keep in mind, that's been in pre-production for years now, so when that will come out is anybody's guess. Along those same lines, he wants to produce a remake of Fantastic Voyage, and he's supposed to have a part in making the new version of Heavy Metal, which again has been in pre-production for about a decade now. He also has a couple of pseudo-documentary type stuff on the horizon. He wants to do a movie called The Dive, which is the true story of Audrey Mester, who was a free diver who died in attempting to set a world record, and The Last Train from Hiroshima, which is a film about the damage that can be caused using nuclear weapons. Not really new ground, but
he does have a thematic approach to his movies. This is a movie about what's bad for the environment.
So, as we said, this could all be stuff that is coming up in the next year. It could be all stuff that may come up in the next decade. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, I think you could tell by our review of James Cameron that Jim and I both give Jim Cameron two thumbs up in the pocket protector. If we haven't said it enough, see Avatar. As always, we thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We encourage your feedback. You could write Jim at twerponline.net. You can also find us on Facebook, MySpace, Zanga, and Twitter.
Thanks for listening, everybody. TwerpCast has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2010.
Donuts.